The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
There have been allegations, lack of soap and hand sanitizer. There's been multiple uses of force. You know, the deployment of pepper spray in these facilities in response to protests related to coronavirus. In some places, even the guards are worried and have incomplete information on who has tested positive for coronavirus. I spoke with the first detainee to test positive for COVID-19 a few weeks ago. And when I spoke with him, he told me that he had been released at that point. He told me that he was convinced that others at the jail he was being held at in New Jersey would come down with the illness.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 13th, 2020. Travel bans, family separation, and changes to asylum rules. The Trump administration has long been embroiled in controversies over its immigration and detention policies. Those controversies have come amidst surges in migrants and asylum seekers, particularly at the U.S. southern border. The Trump administration's new policies have been legally and technically complex. And that was all before COVID-19. This week on the podcast, I sat down with immigration reporters Hamid El-Aziz of BuzzFeed News and Dara Lind of ProPublica, as well as Aaron Reichlin Melnick, a lawyer at the American Immigration Council. We discussed how immigration and customs enforcement, as well as customs and border protection, are responding to COVID-19, the changing legal landscape for those agencies before the pandemic, and the challenges faced by migrants, asylum seekers, and the U.S. immigration system during coronavirus and beyond. It's the Lawfare Podcast, ICE, CBP, and Corona Response.
Let's start with the premise that the coronavirus pandemic has significantly altered the situation on the ground. A little later in the podcast, we can probe whether or not that's actually the case. But with that as the premise, I want to begin with an understanding of the situation within immigration and customs enforcement and custom and border protection prior to this crisis. So with that, Dara, can you describe the evolving situation at the border, especially since the announcement of the Remain in Mexico policy? And can you take us until, say, the beginning of March, when it became clear that the coronavirus would drastically impact life on this continent? What was the Remain in Mexico policy, and how has it impacted the lives of migrants at the border and beyond?
So at the end of 2018, then Homeland Security Secretary Christian Nielsen announced that the U.S. was going to start sending people who came into the U.S. for the purpose of seeking asylum and were caught by Border Patrol agents or were presenting themselves at ports of entry back to wait in Mexico for their asylum hearings, non-Mexican asylum seekers, since a lot of the recent wave of migration has been from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. This would allow them to have court dates in the United States, but they'd get shuttled back and forth into the U.S. for the court date and then sent back to Mexico to wait. This started as a much smaller policy. The Mexican government initially was trying to put limits on how many migrants it would accept. But by summer of last year, it became very widespread across the border. It's still theoretically in place for some populations, even though with the coronavirus restrictions on travel across the border, nobody's actually getting court dates. But the upshot has been that it started a trend that has continued through pilot programs that increased the speed with which people would have their asylum claims heard and then get deported, the cooperative asylum agreements with Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, only the Guatemalan one of which had actually been implemented and which has now been suspended because of the epidemic. But all of these reflected a shift from the U.S. engaging in either what it called catch and release, which is people coming into the U.S. requesting asylum and being allowed to leave ICE detention, and so being able to, you know, fight their case from within the community, or having to detain people indefinitely, to just getting people off U.S. soil as quickly as possible. It was basically a catch and expel policy. Some of those people did have access to asylum cases in the U.S., for example, through Remain in Mexico. Some of them were just kind of ordered deported swiftly, but it allowed the Trump administration to get people out of its custody and avoid the concerns that were raised last year over conditions in Border Patrol custody, over the kind of health risks that were posed when people were placed in these facilities that weren't equipped to hold people, and also to avoid the political damage that comes with bad things happening to migrants on U.S. soil. As much as there was reporting from me and Hamid and basically everybody else on the beat about the targeting of asylum seekers returned to Mexico by smugglers, as much as there was concern that it was basically impossible to get a lawyer for your American court case from Mexico, and lawyers weren't being given any access to their clients in courtrooms, there wasn't enough of a political outcry to really cause problems for the administration with that. So it appeared to have discovered that as long as you can find a legal way to get migrants off U.S. soil, it solves a lot of the optics problems that are associated with having people come into the U.S. and request asylum.
Interesting. Thank you for that. Hamid, your reporting has focused on the conditions of people who weren't expelled but who have still been detained within the United States, as well as the efforts that Dar spoke about to send migrants to third countries. Can you set the pre-COVID scene a little bit for us on those counts?
Yeah, I mean, like Dar was saying, I mean, before the pandemic, the administration was really pushing full steam ahead with an agreement to send asylum seekers from El Salvador and Honduras to Guatemala. Hundreds had already been sent by February. And, you know, DHS was focusing on implementing similar deals with El Salvador and Honduras. This was really the key focus, making sure these agreements were not only implemented, but expanded to include asylum seekers from other countries like Mexico. You know, administration officials believed it would become a deterrent to those making the journey to the southern border. As far as ICE goes, you know, the agency wasn't detaining as many people as it was last summer when there was a peak of around 55,000 people in ICE detention centers, an all-time record. But I think it was about 41,000 in January. There were indications there was going to be expanded internal enforcement targeting sanctuary cities, which was likely going to make the agency even more of a lightning rod during a contentious election year. Obviously, that's all been paused for the moment.
Thank you. So the number has decreased from what it was last summer, but what was the situation like sort of inside these detention centers for both employees and detainees sort of going into the beginning of March? Would you feel comfortable speaking to that?
Sure. I mean, I can say that, you know, as far as my work, and I'm really focused on the medical care within these facilities. And this was starting to become even, you know, more of a focus for Congress. There had been an investigation opened into the medical care within ICE custody. In December, we revealed a whistleblower's claims that detainees were being given incorrect medication, suffering from delays in treating withdrawal symptoms. There was an individual who became so mentally unstable, he lacerated his own penis and required surgery. And we followed on, you know, on that memo with an internal DHS memo written by DHS investigators outlining even more issues in a separate detention facility in New Mexico. So you could already see that congressional officials were going to be focusing on, you know, the care within these facilities.
And Aaron, now that Dara and Hamid have sort of sketched out these policies, can you dig into how the legal architecture of the immigration system has changed, say, since the beginning of the Trump administration to as an endpoint a few weeks ago before the coronavirus crisis really came into full force?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what we've seen under the Trump administration in many ways has been dusting off and activating hidden weapons that were buried in immigration law decades or even generations in the past. We first saw this in the president's first week in office when he relied on a 1952 law, INA Section 212F, to institute the first Muslim ban. That law had never been used in any way like what he used it in his first week. And then we saw the effect that that had in the country and was eventually upheld by the Supreme Court nearly 18 months later. Similarly, with the Remain in Mexico program, the so-called migrant protection protocols involves the dusting off of another rarely used provision of the Immigration and Nationality Act that was added in 1996, the contiguous territory provision. This law, when passed in 1996, almost certainly never anticipated widespread programs used at the border to send tens of thousands of people back to wait in Mexico, and was, as far as scholars can tell, most likely put in the law in order for Mexican nationals who had problems entering the U.S. that would require an immigration judge to wait in their home country of Mexico and then come back to the border for one or two hearings to clear up whatever visa issue they may have had. We also have seen similar things with the so-called asylum cooperative agreements. That's another provision of law, the safe third country provision of asylum law that was added in 1996, and until now had only been used for an agreement between the United States and Canada. With both of these provisions, what the administration has done is take very broad statutory language and twist it even further, creating wide-scale and far-reaching new programs that go far beyond what Congress intended. A good example of this is the Asylum Cooperative Agreement with Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador. All three of these countries do not have robust and strong asylum systems. We know that because many of these governments have said it themselves and because there's extensive evidence showing that. Yet, the Safe Third Country provision requires the U.S. government to certify that any person sent to those countries receive a full and a fair access to an asylum process. So how can you send someone to these systems through these asylum systems in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador when we know for a fact that the systems do not provide a full and fair access to protection? Well, you simply get the Secretary of Homeland Security and the Attorney General to sign a memo declaring, on the basis of what evidence we don't even know, that these countries do in fact have full and fair asylum protection systems, despite every single fact that shows to the contrary. Of course, the Trump administration has done this beyond just the border. Inside the United States, we've seen the public charge rule, a provision that's been in the law for more than a century, be essentially redefined in a way that it establishes a brand new wealth test that will limit legal immigration to the United States. We've seen when ICE has gone after people who are taking sanctuary in churches in order to avoid deportation orders and are utilizing a provision of law that allows them to impose fines of up to $800 a day for failing to depart the country, which led to at least one person receiving a civil fine from ICE of more than $500,000. Now, they suffered a legal defeat in the attempt to fine them, but they are still using these provisions of law, which in many ways have never been used in similar ways before, but have been waiting and buried deep in the law for a long time, ready for the Trump administration to take a hold of them.
And Dara, a lot of your reporting is sourced to people within DHS and within Customs and Border Protection. How have they reacted to these upheavals? What's sort of the environment been inside the organization over these last few years?
I'm also going to kick this to Hamed once I responded, because Hamed is known within the beat for having ludicrously good DHS sourcing. But in my experience, the overall attitude among Border Patrol agents and officials is that they feel that they're finally being given the tools they need. When the Trump administration took office in 2017, and even before that, when Trump was campaigning in 2016, he made a big deal out of, you know, taking the handcuffs off immigration enforcement agents. There was this, at the time, was mostly in the context of ICE, because under the late Obama administration, there were fairly well laid down guidelines or clearly laid down guidelines on who should be a priority for ICE to arrest and deport within the United States. But over the last year and change, as the administration has implemented all of these rapid processing pilots at the border, they've ended up giving a lot of authority to Border Patrol agents to decide what should happen to people, whether somebody should be allowed to remain in the U.S., sent back to Mexico to wait, whether they should be put into a rapid deportation pilot that won't give them as much access to an attorney as they would have in the United States. These are decisions that really are going to define the life or death of an asylum claim. And potentially, you know, if the risk of getting it wrong is that you would determine the life or death of some of the person themselves. And they're being devolved down to Border Patrol agents who don't have a lot of experience in this. You know, there is some reticence among Border Patrol agents in having to like do the official work that was previously given to asylum officers. A pilot to have them formally take over some of those responsibilities has, you know, met with some frustration among both Border Patrol agents and asylum officers. But in general, because there's an institutional understanding among Border Patrol agents that most people who request asylum in the United States are either lying or like don't have a strong enough claim to be upheld, they feel that they're finally being given the tools that they need to have a flexible and effective response so that they're not being forced to hand over a bunch of people to get released into the United States.
Hamid, would you like to follow up?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I think that when I've spoken with other folks in separate parts of DHS, there has been some concern about the legality of these policies and, you know, circumventing, you know, the opportunity for individuals to claim asylum at the border. There's been a lot of concern about unaccompanied immigrant children, especially. You know, we've seen this dramatic downturn and unaccompanied children being allowed to enter the country and go to HHS shelters and seek asylum there. Essentially, they're being turned around and sent back to countries like Guatemala. The numbers of children being sent to these shelters, it's like one or two a day. It's like a 90% downturn compared to what it was even last month. Last year, it was like 100 children a day being sent to shelters. So there's just a lot of concern. And some folks are wondering when there's going to be and if there's going to be any litigation surrounding this. I think it's a pretty sensitive topic, the coronavirus. And it'll be really interesting to see whether or not advocates file any type of lawsuit.
Yeah, I mean, without kind of backing into the coronavirus specific stuff, which I know we like want to kind of get into more fully, I will say that that dynamic has been ongoing for some time, right? In the gap between a policy getting announced and getting implemented, there is often a sentiment within DHS of, well, gee, we don't know how long this is going to remain in place. We assume there's going to be a lawsuit. We assume the Ninth Circuit is going to stop us. We assume the Supreme Court will ultimately let us do it, but we don't know what the timeline is. And in some cases, this has created a really weird and not ideal dynamic that both Hamid and I have reported on, where implementation plans aren't really being developed until really the 11th hour when things are going into effect, because there's kind of a toxic assumption that there's no need to bother to come up with a plan for something because it's just going to get held up in court anyway. And then when and if there isn't litigation immediately, because advocates have started waiting to see how things operate on the ground before filing any litigation, it just turns into something that's underplanned or planned post hoc and not really standardized. Even the Remain in Mexico program, which was rolled out to various parts of the border over the course of several months, as Hamid reported by accessing a leaked internal report late last year, there wasn't even any standardization of what forms were getting used, which you would think they would be able to do if they were, you know, rolling it out to one sector 3 weeks after the next. So the wait and see dynamic isn't just an expression of internal concern among some at DHS about the legality of these things, but it's also even among people who think that these programs are legal and that they are, you know, acting fully within their authority, an assumption that this is all going to be up to the courts anyway, that is preventing or at least excusing a lack of preparation.
And I think one important thing to add on to all of this is the more confusion there is at the border, the easier it is for Border Patrol officers to either get it badly wrong or to believe that they're doing the right thing, but do it in a way that has significantly negative ramifications for the person involved. Even before all of this change occurred at the border, Border Patrol officers had long been documented by internal government watchdogs and non-governmental organizations as being pretty bad at basic asylum screening. A study by the International Commission, U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, a nonpartisan government commission in 2016, found that as much as 10 or 15% of all asylum seekers who went through Border Patrol custody were not given the proper screening and were sent to ICE detention centers without having been transferred to the asylum track, where they would get interviews to determine whether they could stay in the United States and seek asylum. So when the Border Patrol gets all this power and it never starts sending people to ICE detention centers or places where another government agency can check their work, it means that a single agent who misunderstands the law or simply not care about the law can do a lot of damage with really no way for anyone else to fix that mistake at potentially deadly consequences to an asylum seeker or a family or an unaccompanied child.
All of that seems like a pretty good way to transition to an area where policy planning and implementation would be incredibly important. But I think we've seen across the board some struggles with that, which is the response to the coronavirus. So yesterday, the Washington Post reported that nearly 10,000 migrants have been expelled at the border since March 21st, leaving less than 100 in CBP custody, down from nearly 2,000 detainees last year. At this time last year. Dara, last week you broke the story about an internal memo from DHS establishing the policy that may have potentially led to these expulsions. Can you talk about that memo and what's happened since, especially against the backdrop of the pattern of confusion you've just described?
Sure. So the administration announced on March 20th, after a couple of days of speculation of, you know, Trump saying, well, we're looking into this, that they were using a power in federal law that's given to the CDC to bar the entry of people or goods that might introduce an infectious disease into the U.S. It was invoking that power to have the CDC bar the entry of people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border without documents, on the logic that even though there were more coronavirus cases in the U.S. than had been recorded in Mexico at that time, that they could be spreading the virus to different parts of the U.S., that they could just be infecting others with the virus, and that they ran the risk of spreading the virus through these Customs and Border Protection facilities that aren't equipped for medical care or really for housing people at all. At the same time, they implemented at the border a system of processing as many people in the field, quote unquote, which means instead of taking people to a Border Patrol station, they were just running, you know, biometric screenings, doing quick recording of who they were apprehending at the point of apprehension, and then sending them back to Mexico as quickly as possible. In theory, the Mexican government has to, you know, agree to accept people who aren't Mexican nationals. And after days of the Mexican government saying that it wasn't going to do that, it said, okay, we'll allow you to just send back Salvadoran, Guatemalan, and Honduran immigrants. What wasn't clear was exactly how they were going about this. There had been some details that had come out of like how, you know, people were only spending an average of 90 minutes in Customs and Border Protection custody. And it also wasn't clear how this was going to work for asylum seekers, because the text of U.S. asylum law is pretty clear that once you're on U.S. soil, you are allowed to seek humanitarian protection, and that the U.S. has an obligation to give some form of protection, not necessarily asylum, which is a very defined type of legal status in U.S. law, but like there are other lesser forms of protection as well, that, you know, the U.S. has signed international agreements that commit it to giving people access to some form of protection if they can show it's likely that they'll be persecuted in their home countries. According to the memo that I obtained, which in standard Customs and Border Protection fashion, they've never officially acknowledged as legit, but they haven't actually cast specific aspersions on either. And it's been corroborated by things they've told congressional staff and others. They're just not doing any of the processing that is specified under immigration law. They're essentially saying we are creating a new type of thing. Instead of processing these people for immigration processing, we're processing them as part of this Title 42 public health situation. You know, the implication of that is, well, so we're not obligated to do the things that immigration law obligates us to do. The memo that I obtained does say that if someone affirmatively, like spontaneously says to the Border Patrol agent, I am afraid I'm going to be tortured in my home country, and the Border Patrol agent feels that it's a believable claim, then they can go to their supervisor and ask for guidance and, you know, or like ask for approval to keep the person in the US and allow them to apply for protection. But that there's no access to the forms of humanitarian protection that are based on a fear of persecution. Even the lesser forms that the Trump administration has like said in court, it is obligated to grant as a way of arguing that it's not obligated to provide asylum itself to migrants coming in.
Dara, just to respond to that, you've alluded to what conditions on the other side of the border were like prior to COVID-19, but have those conditions changed at all? You know, what are these people who are being turned away from points of entry or expelled from custody? What are they walking into?
So even before the kind of rapid expulsions that we've started seeing under COVID-19, when the only people who were being returned were those who, you know, the Mexican government was officially accepting as part of the Remain in Mexico program, there was still kind of a vacuum of responsibility there. The U.S. officially was not taking any responsibility for the conditions in which migrants were staying. The Mexican government had on paper promised them access to work permits, healthcare, and, you know, just kind of guaranteeing their safety. But in practice, many of these people were unable to find housing in Mexico. Shelters along the border were totally overloaded. There's been a tent city in Matamoros right across, like literally, you can see it from the US side because it's right over the bridge of hundreds, at one point, even 1,000 people just living in what is essentially a refugee camp, except that actual refugee camps have, you know, oversight from the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees. And there was no such, you know, centralized oversight happening here. So those are themselves not great epidemiological conditions for an infectious disease. And so there have been already concerns about it spreading to migrants who are waiting on the, you know, Mexican side of the border. Tijuana has really had it spread pretty actively. There are concerns on the kind of Mexican side of the Texas-Mexico border as well. And then added onto that is the question of what is happening to people once they get just expelled as part of this policy. The Mexican Migration Agency doesn't appear to be doing a whole lot with their taking a lot of responsibility. There isn't enough shelter capacity to easily like build up. And so the question is, are people just going to be actively dispersed to other towns, which the Mexican government and international organizations have done some of in order to, you know, get rid of the crunch at the border? Are they going to be swiftly deported back to their home countries? Is there going to be some kind of clutched together infrastructure that gets built up in the same way that a clutched together infrastructure kind of got built up for the folks, you know, sent via Remain in Mexico? But fundamentally, after an average of 96 minutes in Border Patrol custody, everything that we've heard, you know, from reporting and from people on the ground is that people don't even know what happened to them. They don't know why they got sent back. They don't know if they're supposed to be, you know, waiting or continuing to seek asylum or what. And so the lack of proactive communication about this, which does appear to be to a certain extent deliberate on the part of the Trump administration, like their view appears to be that if they proactively communicate who is and isn't eligible to stay in the U.S., that it's going to encourage smugglers to tell people how to get around the system. But the vacuum of information, you know, does mean that people who do get sent back don't have a great way to figure out what they should do next.
Now, Hamid, can you walk us through the last several weeks inside ICE detention centers around the U.S., both for detainees and for employees? And again, can you just give us the scale in terms of numbers of places and people that we're talking about? Because I think that'll be really helpful for some unfamiliar listeners.
Sure. You know, the mood inside ICE detention centers has been incredibly tense. Detainees are hunger striking, protesting, panicking about the potential spread of this disease within these cramped facilities. There have been allegations, lack of soap and hand sanitizer. There's been multiple uses of force, you know, the deployment of pepper spray in these facilities in response to protests related to coronavirus. In some places, even the guards are worried and have incomplete information on who has tested positive for coronavirus. I spoke with the first detainee to test positive for COVID-19 a few weeks ago. And when I spoke with him, he told me that he had been released at that point. He told me that he was convinced that others at the jail he was being held at in New Jersey would come down with the illness. And just a few days later, somebody, an ICE detainee, did. In those detention centers where there have been outbreaks, we've seen a few of these places where there have been 10 individuals who have been tested positive for COVID-19 or up to 8 individuals who have tested positive for COVID-19. Detainees are especially worried. One individual in a facility in Pennsylvania told me that he was losing his mind just in fear of what was coming next. So right now, ICE is detaining just over 33,000 people in hundreds of private and local county jails across the country. At this point, ICE officials have reported publicly of 50 confirmed COVID-19 cases within custody. That number is expected to balloon in the coming days and weeks. Advocates believe that the number is actually higher than what's being reported. And there's been allegations of a lack of testing, a lack of tracking these cases. So the situation is really unfolding, rapidly. And so, yeah, there's a lot to be, there's a lot left to see, what's going to happen in these facilities.
And you mentioned that the first person who, the first detainee who was diagnosed with COVID-19 was released. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, there's two things happening. There's one, litigation from immigrant advocates like the ACLU actually going to federal judges and getting orders to force ICE to release detainees in custody because they have underlying medical conditions or are elderly. We've seen dozens of detainees be released that way. At the same time, ICE has been, for the past few weeks, looking through its roster of detainees for quote-unquote vulnerable immigrants in custody. Similarly, elderly folks with underlying medical conditions, individuals who are pregnant, for potential release. I believe they found 600 detainees who fit this bill. And as of March 30th, they'd released 160 detainees. Obviously, advocates believe that number should be way higher, given that there are more than 33,000 immigrants in custody at this point.
Dara?
So just to kind of to explain why the pressure on ICE to release detainees has been kind of why that's been the locus. Unlike people who are sentenced to a certain criminal sentence that is defined, because ICE detention is civil confinement, it's not entirely discretionary. There are some cases in which the law does say that people have to be detained, but many of the people who are currently being detained don't fit into those categories. They're being detained because ICE has made the determination that they would be a risk to public safety, or that they would try to abscond and not show up to their court hearings. There's a lot of evidence that those decisions aren't necessarily being made on a case-by-case basis, that there are kind of top-down directives to just detain everybody. There have been lawsuits that the ACLU has brought in certain in the South in particular, that field offices there aren't doing case-by-case determinations. The New York Civil Liberties Union recently revealed that they had found via FOIA evidence that the risk assessment algorithm that was being used to detain people no longer spit out a recommendation of release. The only recommendations were detain and ask your supervisor. And so what ICE is doing by acknowledging now that there are high risk people who could be released, it is taking a step that it has not taken under the Trump administration in being willing to, you know, to consider some people, quote unquote, safe to release. Of course, that's not to say that they're being totally unmonitored. And it does appear to be based on the risks of them contracting coronavirus while in detention, rather than being based on, okay, you know, these are the lowest risk to escape detainees, as some kind of states and counties have been doing on the jail side. But it has called attention to something that advocates and Democrats have been saying for some time, that ICE doesn't need to be detaining as many people as it does, and that because it's all a matter of ICE's discretion, there's nothing stopping it from releasing more people than it already has.
Aaron, I want to turn to you to just ask if you have any follow-up to what Dara and Hamid have just laid out, but I'm also wondering if you can explain sort of what will happen next for someone who's released from ICE custody.
Sure. So I want to build a little bit first on what Dara said. It's really important to recognize that ICE really does have the authority to release almost any person in their detention centers. And it is very, very rare when ICE actually has its hands tied and believes that the law prevents it from releasing anybody. That's because ICE can release the majority of people from detention in one of four ways. They can issue a bond that the person can pay, and then that person can leave detention and pursue their court hearings outside of detention. ICE can release the person on an alternative to detention program, such as a case management program, or through the use of an ankle monitor and mandatory check-ins every month, which eventually then turn into mandatory check-ins every 2 or 3 months or every 6 months as the case goes on. ICE can also simply release people on their own recognizance. There are thousands of people that ICE used to release on their own recognizance that the Trump administration has simply stopped issuing those orders of release for. As Dara mentioned, in New York, for 40% of people that ICE arrested in New York, they used to just release them and ask them to attend their court hearings elsewhere. Then they tweaked the algorithm, and now the algorithm recommends that 0% of people are released. And lo and behold, virtually no one is ever released. And finally, ICE has the authority to parole people into the United States. This is particularly important for the asylum seekers in detention. As of April 4th, roughly a sixth of all people in ICE detention are asylum seekers who have already gone through the first phase of the asylum process and have been found by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services to have credibly established a fear of persecution in their home country, which puts them through the next path on seeking asylum. ICE could issue parole to almost every single one of these nearly 6,000 people tomorrow and release all of them. But ICE has chosen not to. And instead, they have chosen to release a few hundred high-risk detainees. But the problem is that isn't going to help. It's going to save the lives, likely, of a few of those high-risk detainees. But when coronavirus makes its way into detention centers, and it's already in more than a dozen nationwide, it's going to spread through there, and it's going to send many people to the hospital. That is going to stress local hospital resources. That is going to make the risk of dying from coronavirus significantly higher for both people in detention and as well as for members of the local communities who are now going to see their local hospitals overwhelmed because ICE chose not to release people. Now, you wanted to know what happens to people once they're released from detention. So there's a lot of confusion around this. Many people believe that once somebody is released, they often fail to appear in court or abscond and disappear. But I've done the analysis of this data, and the reality is that the vast majority of people, when they are released by ICE, return and appear for every single court hearing. Between 2008 and 2019, 83% of every single person who was either released from detention or was never detained in the first place appeared for every single court hearing. So less than 20% of people ever missed a single court hearing. And of those who missed court hearings, they often missed it because of government error. There's a lot of chaos and confusion inside the immigration court system, which has a 1.1 million case backlog and not nearly enough staff to ensure that all the paperwork is filed properly, addresses are updated, and things along those lines. So quite often, people miss court simply because the court didn't send them a letter in time. One classic example of this is a study was done on people who had been ordered removed for missing court of families who were seeking asylum. In 36 out of 36 cases where they filed motions to reopen, to restart the hearing because an immigrant had been ordered removed for missing court, they were able to successfully reopen every single one of them because the fault was on the government. And one great example of that was a person who received two letters in the mail one day. She had been released from detention and told, "We're going to send you a letter telling you when your first court date is, and just make sure you go to your hearing. And if you miss your hearing, you'll get ordered deported." So every day she checked her mail. And then one day she got two letters from the court. Now, the first was a letter telling her that she needed to show up in court the previous week. And then the second was a letter telling her that she'd been ordered deported for missing that court date the previous week. And so, unfortunately, that happens to a lot of people. But what it really emphasizes is that most people, the vast majority of people, when released from ICE detention, will go live with family, live with friends. They'll be able to socially distance. And when the court hearings start up again, they're going to go to those court hearings and they're going to go through the process.
So a good follow-up to that is, what's happening with the immigration courts right now?
It has been chaos in the immigration court system in the past 6 weeks. What's very clear is that EOIR, the Executive Office for Immigration Review, the agency that controls the immigration court system, was not prepared for a pandemic, and it was not prepared for a world in which concentrating large numbers of people in tiny little courtrooms is not possible. By early March, people were already calling for the courts to be closed because they realized that requiring people, thousands of people every single day, to drive from towns and local communities around the nation to the few immigration courts that exist was going to be a public health nightmare. But it took until Friday, March 13th for EOIR to really start making any significant changes. On March 13th, they suspended some initial hearings, which would have affected probably 50 or 60% of all the hearings scheduled in court, and they put those on hold. And then the week after that, they suspended all non-detained hearings, which is about 95% of all hearings. But because they waited until mid to late March, the effects were already disastrous. At least two immigration judges have been infected with the coronavirus. We know of at least one ICE trial attorney, which is their essentially immigration court prosecutors, who is at one point was in a coma. I believe she's gotten better, though I'm not sure. And we are almost certain that some immigrants went to court and likely became infected and through community spread at small courtrooms. You know, many people hear the word court and they think of a big courtroom like they see on TV with, you know, essentially large amounts of seats in the back and a huge space. But the reality is that immigration courtrooms are usually in federal office buildings. They're small. Each courtroom maybe fits about a few dozen people at most. A lot of people have to crowd into really small waiting rooms outside, like being in the waiting room at the doctor. You're like really crammed in. And so they were real vectors for community spread because it concentrated lots of people in small places. And since then, the immigration court system has still refused to close all immigration courts, requiring some people to continue to appear for hearings that are continuing to go on in detention centers, which continues to put judges and attorneys and immigrants at risk. What this has also led to is an unprecedented collaboration between the union that represents immigration judges, the union that represents ICE trial attorneys, and the Immigration Lawyers Association, who 2 weeks ago issued a joint letter calling for the courts to be fully closed and for all vital court matters to be transitioned to online hearings only, a lot like what state and federal courts have done. And there's really one quote that captures this best from an anonymous immigration judge that was given to the Immigration Judges Union. This judge, who was a former military veteran, said that, I've never witnessed an utter lack of concern for people like I have here. In my former life, we treated captured Taliban and ISIS with more humanity. Moreover, I have never seen worse leadership. A crisis usually brings good and bad to the light. We have nothing but darkness. So as you can tell, immigration judges are not happy with what their headquarters is doing.
Wow. Thank you. Before we wrap up, Hamid, I want to ask you sort of about another part of the immigration system that has been affected by COVID-19. And to do that, I'm wondering if you can tell the story of Luis Molina, who is a person you profiled in a piece you wrote earlier this week.
Yeah, so Luis Molina is a 51-year-old immigrant from El Salvador. He'd been scheduled to complete the final step in a year-long journey to become an American citizen on March 19th in Los Angeles. He was due that day to repeat the oath of allegiance to the U.S. along with hundreds of other would-be citizens. To give a little background, to become a U.S. citizen, immigrants must go through this long and sometimes challenging process that includes an interview with an immigration officer, a test on American civics and English language. But the final step is really, really simple, really easy. It's repeating 140 words in this celebratory event that's often held in theaters, convention centers, courthouses. I've actually spoken at one. It's a really lovely setting. But because of the pandemic, these ceremonies have been put on an indefinite hold. And would-be citizens like Luis are worried about the chance to complete the citizenship process.
Well, thank you all for agreeing to get on the phone with me today to talk about this. I know in your separate lives as immigration attorneys and reporters, you are all incredibly busy at this time. We're running a little short. So what I want to do is ask each of you in turn, what are you going to be watching for over the next several weeks? And what aspects of changes in policies that we've discussed that are COVID specific do you think are going to stick around? And what do you think is sort of going to happen in the long and medium term after the curve is flattened?
Sure. I think that the question of what happens in Mexico is going to be extremely important for not necessarily determining what the U.S.'s continued border response looks like. If we've seen one thing consistently from the Trump administration, it's that no matter whether a lot of people are trying to come into the U.S. or very few, they still take the attitude that anyone coming in is an, you know, unacceptable crisis level situation. So we can expect that crackdown to last as long as they can, you know, uphold it against the courts if any litigation arises. But how many people are trying to come in really is going to depend on how bad coronavirus gets on the Mexican side. Even among countries in the region, the Mexican government was notably slow to respond. The president of Mexico has been one of the more weirdly blasé leaders about the whole thing. And so the odds that it becomes a serious ongoing problem in Mexico, that's now a very realistic possibility. So on the one hand, that could have a deterrent effect on people traveling north through Mexico from Central American countries, even from South America, even what are often called extracontinentals or people who, you know, fly from Cameroon or India into Brazil or Ecuador and then travel all the way north to the US. On the other hand, we're seeing an increase in people requesting asylum from Mexico as the security situation there deteriorated, especially in, you know, states like Michoacan. And if it becomes you know, endemic in Mexico in kind of a worst case scenario way, it's totally plausible that a lot of Mexicans will try to escape to the US to flee the coronavirus. What the Trump administration, you know, would decide to do in that situation is unclear, but it does mean that as much of a crisis footing as they're on right now in terms of the, you know, protecting exposure within the US, that could get much worse before it gets better.
Aaron?
The changes that coronavirus are going to cause to the immigration system are unclear. I think you're going to see a lot of pressure from immigration restrictionists to cut legal immigration even further, building off what the Trump administration has already done and expanding restrictions even more. At the border, it's hard to see the Trump administration lifting their new expulsion policy anytime soon. We know that absent a miracle, coronavirus is going to continue spreading across the world for months and likely through to 2021. And what that means is that as long as that's happening, the Trump administration will have an excuse to continue doing what they've done, wanted to be able to do ever since Trump took office, which is effectively shut down all asylum at the southern border. So I expect that these so-called expulsions are going to continue for months or potentially longer, absent a court order stopping them. And when it comes to those held inside the United States, the disruptions to the immigration court system and to immigration detentions are going to continue for quite some time. But there will likely be significant pressure on the immigration court system from the White House to restart as soon as possible, because every day that the hearings don't go forward, the 1.1 million case backlog gets a little bit longer. So inside the U.S., the disruptions could continue for months. At the border, I expect them to continue, barring a court order, through to, at least to the end of Trump's first term in office.
And Hamid?
Yeah, for me, I'm going to be watching to see how coronavirus spreads within ICE detention facilities, what the numbers look like in a week, in 2 weeks, in 3 weeks, and how ICE handles potential outbreaks in specific facilities. You know, if there are dozens of detainees who come down with coronavirus in a single facility, what ICE does in that situation. If these releases continue and what the numbers will look like in a few weeks, the number of immigrants in custody. At the same time, I'm really interested to see what USCIS does in a few weeks and whether or not they intend to open up their offices to the public. Right now, obviously, they're all closed. And what happens if they do open up these offices? What measures are they going to take to protect their employees, to protect immigrants coming in for citizenship interviews, and how they're going to handle a similar backlog in citizenship applications and other really vital immigration benefits.
We're going to leave it there. Dara, Hamid, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you found this podcast useful, please share us on the platform or platforms of your choosing and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. The podcast was produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell. Ian Enright was our audio engineer this week, and our music was performed by Sophia Yan. Have a safe week, and as always, thanks for listening.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.